This podcast was originally live streamed on the Non Sequitur Show on YouTube. New episodes air weekdays, Monday through Friday, at 8 p.m. Eastern at youtube.com/nonsequiturshow. Make sure you never miss a live stream by visiting www.nonsecshow.com/schedule. For the latest news, polls and updates throughout the day, follow us on Twitter at nonsecshow or facebook.com/nonsecshow. That's NONSEQ show. If you'd like to get exclusive content, bi-weekly private hangouts with Kyle and Steve, backstage access to chat with guests after shows hosted on your channel and much more, become a Patreon saint of Non Sequitur. It ensures we continue to improve our show and brings you into the process at the same time. Visit patreon.com/nonsequitur today while the limited spots are still available.
The following podcast is intended for those who believe bold ideas are righteous, unique perspectives are gospel, and strong opinions are sacred. This is Non Sequitur. Never follow. And now, here are your hosts, Kyle Curtis and Steve McRae.
You know what I did? I had the stream up, and whenever it cut back to the screen I'm used to seeing, all I heard was "Oh Lord" playing. So sorry you had to see that little behind the scenes, guys, but you are used to that. We actually made it on time tonight. Usually, Lucian, we're not on time at all. We're usually either late or there's some type of tech glitch, but in the year and a half that we've been doing the show, we have yet to have a smooth, professional opener. So it's just another day in paradise.
Well, no, it's not the time to start.
That's exactly
right.
Why
break tradition, right? Yeah, exactly.
Exactly right. Thank you guys for joining us. If you joined us last night, that was a lot of fun. Go back and watch it if you haven't. Well, that doesn't really make sense. You wouldn't go back and watch it if you hadn't watched it yet. But go watch it because Aaron Rod joined me. We took your calls for about 2 hours, and about midway through, we had Steve. You remember Catholic traditionalist or the traditional Catholic?
I do. He called an atheist experience at one time,
right?
Or was it?
So he called last.
I think it was talking to you.
He called in last
you
night.
And you were on, wasn't it? Yeah.
He called in last night and said that he can prove God because 1,000 years ago there was a cracker. Or a block of bread. He used both terms. I'm not sure how you do both, but it turns into a pound of flesh, and it is in this church, and science can't explain it. And it literally, by that sentence, for the next 45 minutes, was just a nonstop shouting match between traditional Catholic and Aaron. And Aaron had been about, a couple in, so It was quite the night. If you didn't get to see that, please go and watch that. I guarantee you will not be disappointed.
Apparently, flesh and meat are not the same thing. Just saying.
Right. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Well, that's what he was saying. I don't know. It was strange. It was very strange. So tonight we have Lucian Greaves, right? I want to make sure I say your last name correctly.
That is correct.
Awesome. A lot of people, and when I say a lot, I mean a lot of people, have been hitting me up over the past couple of weeks to get this guy on, and thankfully, he took the time to join us. We were having a conversation prior to starting the stream that I think is going to just be fantastic to have. A lot of you remember the controversy we were embroiled in about platforming, and it seems like we have sort of a similar view on that, and I think that'll be good to sort of talk about as well, because it seems to be an issue that is, by the day, getting worse, and I think it's important to talk about. But let me just take a second and introduce Lucian properly. Lucian Greaves is a social activist and the spokesman and co-founder of the Satanic Temple. Greaves has appeared in numerous media outlets and has made televised appearances on the Fox News Network. He is a public speaker and essayist who has contributed to articles and publications, including Skeptic Magazine, Skeptical Inquirer, The Washington Post, and International Business Times. Welcome, sir, and thank you once again for taking the time to join us here tonight.
Thank you for having me. Somebody on Twitter said she can die in peace now.
Yeah, that's the other thing too. It comes with a lot of bribery. I've gotten that somebody will love me forever. One person said that they would never leave another negative comment on a video if you came on. So I don't know what it is, but you have that power. It's Satan, right? You made a deal with Satan. It has to be Satan.
Must be, but unfortunately for me, I only tend to notice the hate mail and the disparaging comments. I can go through miles of texts that are saying glowing things, and I'll see the one thing that says I'm an asshole, and that's the one that gets me.
Well, that's what we do. That's like us. Yep. That one comment destroys all the other ones. It makes us sad.
Steve. Before we jump in, did you have anything you needed to, you have anything coming up or anything like that you want to put out there?
I do actually. I'm going to be going to Anaheim here next week. We are going to be trying to recreate a flat Earth experiment up in the LA region with Ruhif. Actually, I'm going to try to be a videographer to that and hopefully get some like live stuff. Maybe we can stream while we're doing or mm-hmm. something like that, but that's gonna be really interesting. I'm looking forward to that. I don't know what experiment we're going to be doing. I think we're going to do a Benford level experiment with a theodolite.
Fascinating. Well, good. Cool. Tomorrow I have just one announcement and then we'll get into it, but as many of you know, a very big issue is it's come up in every stream that we've done since Faithless Forum last night. There was a caller that asked the question, and Aaron gave his stance on there. There's been a lot of talk about the rationality rules and the atheist community of Austin situation. Tomorrow, we'll actually be joined by Jamie Booth, who is the president of the ACA, to go through everything, the response, what they're hoping to see out, the outcome out of this situation, that sort of thing. So we're going to have a conversation about that tomorrow. It's going to be at 9:00 Eastern. So you can join us for that. And that way that side will be out there. There'll be a lot less, I hope, speculation about where everybody stands. And I think it'll be good to sort of get out there. Lucian, Let's start out with letting you people know how you sort of became involved and what your motivation was for starting the Satanic Temple, because it's getting easier now. People can accept that a lot easier than they could even, I think, 10 years ago. So it's got to be really cool to see the progress that the country seems to be taking.
Well, I have to credit us for that directly. I think before the Satanic Temple, you didn't see people talking about Satanism the way they do now. You didn't see people talking about it as though it were some kind of legitimate religious identity. And even now they try to denigrate it and say that it isn't. But you see even Fox News being more circumspect. It was even a couple years ago, I saw a commentator on Fox News talking about Satanists and saying these terrible things and then deciding to add the caveat in a Trump-like fashion saying, but I'm sure some of them are very good people or something like that, or that they're not all like that or something. And I don't think you ever heard anything like that before the Satanic Temple came along. And I think that's entirely our doing. But my original interest in Satanism derived from the Satanic Panic when I was a kid. There were these stories of these satanic cults breeding babies just for the purpose of murdering them, cannibalizing missing persons, working to undo the moral fabric of society for the ends of some kind of world domination plot. And these are really kind of extreme conspiracy theories that we recognize as such now, but they gained mainstream acceptance on daytime talk shows and in mainstream press in general. And in a certain subsection of the psychotherapeutic community, there was this idea that they could recover hidden traumatic memories of satanic ritual abuse. And, you know, therapists who subscribed to this idea tended to resurrect these memories from people's minds. And naturally, it's easy to see that the kind of questions they were asking people were leading them to come to these conclusions, in the same way that somebody who does recovered memory therapies upon people they suspect were abducted by aliens, or they have a specialty in recovering memories of that, they tend to recover only those types of memories. And people who have a predilection for searching for memories of satanic ritual abuse, they tend to find those as well. It's a debunked practice, but it's still practiced today, and that's something we fight back against. But when I was a kid and I was seeing these claims, I was young enough that initially I took them at face value, and to know that there were these extreme kind of occult criminal society working in the background was a very jarring thing to learn about, right? And to see people kind of taking that casually, or to see that kind of narrative fade away without resolution, was interesting to me. So I kind of pursued this later on and was wondering what was the real root of these stories. By the time I was in high school, I think I was really kind of intrigued by this, and to learn more and more that these were simply the irresponsible claims of modern day witch hunters, that none of these things were true. And furthermore, researching to find out who actually did self-identify as a Satanist in reading this kind of literary canon of satanic materials, and growing an affinity for this metaphorical, iconic Satan as the rebel against tyranny and the inquirer for knowledge in the face of superstition, was very appealing, especially when you add to that I'm becoming more and more disillusioned with traditional religious institutions as disclosures come out regarding their corruption, their cover-ups of pedophilic crimes and other such things, really rather solidified me as a Satanist. And that stuck with me for some time. But I didn't feel a real need to come out publicly and declare myself a public Satanist, especially with my keen awareness of the Satanic Panic as it happened. And to do so, in fact, felt suicidal. But I had some friends, and they wanted to work on a film project. And the idea of the film project was that, a minority religious group would be fighting for the same privileges and exemptions that the theocrats in the United States were pushing for. And nobody else, or they didn't count on anybody else trying to take advantage of those doors they were kicking open and couldn't close behind them. And to kind of reassert the notion that we're a pluralistic nation, and the government needs to engage in viewpoint neutrality insofar as questions of religion are concerned, it would be really jarring for an extreme alternative religious voice to come forward and say that they were going to engage in these same things. And the thing is I was the Satanist, so I was consulting at first. I still didn't want my face on this, and I just wanted to be sure that Satanism was properly represented and not represented as some type of crass joke. Satanists get shit on enough that I wanted to make sure that there was some kind of respect for Satanism in this project they were working on. And it didn't take long, though. It was pretty much after the first action we did, which was a rally in support of Rick Scott, the governor of Florida, who had put forward a bill in Florida so that his students could lead prayer in school. And the idea was that we would be in support of this bill because it opened the door for Satanists to openly practice in school. So that would be like the unintended consequence. We wouldn't do that kind of thing now because it kind of obscures what we really believe. We think a guy like Rick Scott is an asshole and we don't want people to think we actually support him. But in the beginning, we were willing to take a real kind of pranksterish kind of approach to this kind of thing. And as soon as we did that and as soon as it got media attention, I found that it was really difficult for me to sit back while an actor I was coaching would try to field media discussions without a real authentic attachment to Satanism himself. You just can't feed somebody answers in real time. So I decided to step in. And then at that point, it wasn't a film project anymore. The cameras needed to shut off. And I took a primary role. And that's all shown in the Hail Satan film. But what's disappointing to me is that a lot of the reviewers still kind of mistake it as being an evolution from merely a joke into an authentic religious attachment and kind of miss the point that I was already a self-identified Satanist and was already authentically attached to this philosophy of Satanism to begin with. So even while the project itself, called the Satanic Temple, migrated over into an actual religious organization, it's not that we created a satanic philosophy just to justify some sort of pranksterism. You know, it just, and even when it was a project that my friends were making, it wasn't just a prank to them either. It wasn't mere trolling. It wasn't just something to get a reaction. The issues really meant something, right? This was activist filmmaking. But that very quickly changed. And now, you know, we're to the point where we're an IRS recognized church, and it's kind of, and that's the only federal institution that has any test for what makes a religion. And I think now it's a whole different story.
And we're going to get there here in just a few minutes too, talking about the status change. But there are two sort of follow up questions to that I want to kind of hone in on. What was the reception that you got from the public when you started the Satanic Temple? Like, what was the, did you get lots of pushback? Were there people protesting you? And the numbers, like, what was the, would you say your, if you had to guess your, the church size was then compared to what it is now?
Well, I was correct at the beginning where I thought that we would be speaking for a large population that was really unrecognized. There are a lot of people who were interested in LaVey and Satanism, but could no longer hold on to their kind of, the Church of Satan's kind of deference to magic or supernormal powers in the ritual chamber or other such kind of allusions to supernatural bullshit, even though they're non-theistic. They're very unclear as to where they stand regarding this whole idea of magic. And we're very much non-supernaturalists. We don't accept supernatural explanations for anything. And we walk away from that kind of Ayn Randian social Darwinist construct that's advanced by the LaVeyan system. And in fact, scholars of modern Satanism have looked at modern satanic subcultures and found that they're mostly very liberal, despite that LaVeyan kind of right-wing libertarianism that's generally ignored by the people who really subscribe to or claim to subscribe to LaVeyan Satanism. So I felt that there was going to be a large population that was going to really embrace what the Satanic Temple was doing. And I was right. So that response was massive right away. But the response I got from my own immediate network of friends and my general peer network, it wasn't very good. I had already been kind of developing a market of my own as kind of a a pop science writer, especially interested in issues related to this ongoing problem of recovered memory therapies and this notion of repressed trauma that seems to justify to some of these fringe therapists, these recovered memory therapy tactics. And so my writing was very appealing to some of the older people who were affected by the satanic panic directly, people who had really suffered from accusations of Satanism when they had no affiliation with any type of Satanism whatsoever. So to them, they were Satanists by attribution, right? This was a pejorative placed upon them to say that they were some kind of depraved criminals. So when I came out doing what I was doing, this was appalling to some of them. And a lot of people at that time just cut all contact with me. You know, my social network kind of disintegrated around me. So it was a very painful and abrupt experience at first. Everything was overhauled and we got a lot of media attention right away. And that's also something I've never been very good at handling. It's put me on the verge of full-on agoraphobia sometimes. You know, it can be very difficult for me, just that amount of personal attention. I'm just not really constructed for it. And so...
Has it gotten easier?
It's gotten easier, but it's also gotten... I've also gotten much more praise in recent times. In kind of the apex of that now is the Hail Satan film coming out. And I was so used to most every mainstream media discussion I would have with a journalist being hostile, or if not hostile, then at least they would be taking an extreme devil's advocate position against me, you know, in deference to what they thought the audience would be thinking. And that all seemed to change at Sundance when Hail Satan premiered. And I was going into these, you know, they set up a whole press schedule for me and the director. And we were going around to these mainstream journalists writing reviews, doing interviews and things like that. And it was a whole new world for me, because some of these interviews were starting out with the interviewer saying things like, "I find what you're doing heroic and uplifting." And I thought, this is not how interviews with me are supposed to begin. I almost didn't know how to handle it. I'd almost become comfortable with a hostile interview. And now this is a whole new experience all on its own. I kind of think the other shoe will drop once this film is actually streaming, because we've gotten almost universally good reviews. People really seem to love the film. But once it's streaming, we're going to see those people who wouldn't buy a ticket to see the Satanist film posting their opinion and their outrage about it.
Did you ever think that you would get to a point in, especially America, where it seems to be like, if you contrast these characters, Satan is becoming the good guy and God is on a daily basis becoming the villain. Like people, it seems like those attitudes are changing a little bit. I never thought that would be the case. Like you would have not convinced me that there would come a day where a film about Satanists would come out and the reception to it would be, you know, sort of embracing you really. That's crazy to hear.
This is right. This is the backlash to the theocratic movement in the United States. And I think when people look back in the future, when they look back at when Satanism really took hold, and I think now with the Satanic Temple, it really will, and the Pew polls are going to have to start reckoning on the non-theistic Satanism as defined by the Satanic Temple as being a legitimate religious voice in the United States. They're going to say that theocratic movement helped birth the satanic uprising and make it a worldwide global phenomenon as it's really becoming now. because it really helps people see why we're relevant and really what we're saying to begin with. I felt this way for a long time, and I felt very much kind of oppressed by that cultural, that Judeo-Christian superstitious cultural background that I had to begin with, which kind of helped me define my own affirmative values. So it was, as a scholar said in the Hail Satan film, to say that Satanists are anti-Christian is only a half-truth. We're post-Christian. We've left Christianity decisively, but we're taking Satan with us. And Satan really means something to us. It's this kind of cultural, artistic raw material by which we contextualize our community, our ethics, and kind of our narrative place in our cultural context, right? Some people feel like if you're non-theistic, that this imagery must not really mean anything to you. And it's just not true. I mean, for some people, it just doesn't resonate. It was interesting listening to Penn Jillette talking to the director of Hail Satan, Penny Lane. And in Penny Lane herself did not have any type of religious upbringing. So the satanic symbolism and things like that just don't mean as much to her. She doesn't feel like she's a Satanist. She feels like she's an ally to Satanists. But some of us, we grew up with this symbolic structure, and we had these kinds of ideas fed into our heads that a certain type of symbolic act, you know, was blasphemy and could cause our everlasting souls to be forever tormented. So embracing blasphemy at a certain point was a really kind of uplifting and transcendent moment where we were really shaking free of those shackles of superstition. And even though we don't believe in the supernatural aspects of any of what we have done, that kind of symbolic activity can mean a lot to us, and it can really kind of help create a sense of community for people who agree with that and engage in that as well. After a while, you kind of outgrow the need to just wantonly engage in blasphemy, even as a personal act of independence. But the kind of power of that never leaves you. You still understand that you came from that, and it's still meaningful to you. And what I think is very much a genuine religious sense.
And you sort of led into my next question there. Yeah. As a Satanist, can you, for people who may not know, do you believe in Satan? Can you sort of clear this up? What, when you say you're taking Satan with you, what do you mean by what's sort of the tenet of the Satanic Temple?
Well, I mean, we see Satan as a literary construct, right? I was talking about Satan as this kind of metaphorical, cultural, raw artistic material, and that's what it is, you know. And I think a lot of people do understand that, you know. They see, you know, the real danger posed by the theocratic push, you know, the Mike Pence's in office. You know, they see these abortion restrictions coming up state by state. They see the disposition of the Supreme Court right now, and they're seeing now the real need for a kind of outside voice to assert these kind of basic constitutional values that we're the ones protecting. And it's interesting to see this kind of cause of division within the right as well. Because for the most part, you know, are the people who follow the Satanic Temple, and for the people for whom this really resonates, they're on the progressive left. But we also see articles about us in right-wing media, like Breitbart, Daily Caller, or whatever. And it's interesting to look at the comments. In the comment threads, you'll see people who comment on these pages regularly, and there will sometimes be divisions. For the most part, people on that side of the argument are saying we're simply evil due to this, the symbolism we use. It doesn't even matter what our positions are on the issues. You know, we shouldn't have an equal place at the table. We're a Christian nation, things like that. And for some of them, though, that just doesn't sit well. The cognitive dissonance is too much, because for so long, they wanted to view themselves as the voices of religious liberty, the constitutional purists, and they recognize that they can't have it both ways. So I really like to see us sowing that kind of discontent within the right in similar ways. I think discontent has been sowed within the left in prior times, and it's causing a kind of reevaluation. And I'm hoping it can be just a part of the ultimate collapse of this bizarre kind of superstitious right-wing nationalism and its fight to redefine us as a Christian nation with this kind of Christian history in a very theocratic way that just runs counter to everything that's true about the founding of the United States and its place, at least ostensibly on paper, as a secular nation.
It's funny to say that. And Steve, let me say this one last thing, then I'm going to let you go with your question. We actually had Andrew Seidel from the Freedom from Religion Foundation on last week to talk about his book, which it speaks to that very point, fighting against that that notion that the United States was founded on a Christian principles. And that was a fascinating talk. I think when you it's interesting the reception that we got from that video, because what I'm seeing is that a lot of people aren't really familiar with the truth of how the nation was sort of founded, and they're getting this sort of whitewashed story of these Christian principles that are tacked on after the fact. You know, looking back, all the founders were, you know, believed in God, but if you look at what actually happened there, it couldn't be further from the case.
Andrew's actually a friend of mine, and he came to us right away when he saw the activities that the Satanic Temple were doing. And I think it speaks to the integrity of the Freedom from Religion Foundation that they could recognize us as a religious voice and also see that when we were going into the public square, we were very clear that we were not opening the door to religious displays whenever we were asking for a religious display to be in place, because we felt and still feel that it's probably not the best place for it. You know, if you're going to have to accommodate all religious voices. And we were very clear when we were seeking to put up our Baphomet monument in Oklahoma and then in Arkansas, that if the Ten Commandments monuments weren't there on the public grounds, we would withdraw our Baphomet monument or our claim to have a right to put a Baphomet monument there. We'd stop the fight, because what we were looking to avoid more than looking to achieve was the appearance of a single religious viewpoint having that power and authority, of having exclusive privilege on public grounds. We were asserting or reasserting that we're a pluralistic nation that respects diversity and holding the government to the standard of remaining neutral on those kinds of questions. You don't want the government taking ownership of religion to the point where they dictate what is appropriate religious expression. And the FFRF understood that immediately and was willing to accept us as plaintiffs in these kinds of cases where we were testing these things out. And in some cases, they even reached out to us to inquire if we were interested in putting places to that test. Belle Plaine in Minnesota, this small town where in a park somebody had put up a what was supposed to be a veterans memorial. It was this image of a cross with the silhouette of a soldier kneeling near it. And somebody complained to the FFRF and said that this, you know, was clearly a religious monument and it needed to come down. FFRF wrote to the city council, told them that this was in violation, and the city council agreed to take it down. And then the Alliance Defending Freedom came in, found a local, went to a city council meeting, and they proposed what they thought was this kind of perfect argument where they said they could open up those same grounds as a public forum. And as such, it would just be discriminatory to keep out religious voices. You know, it would be an open forum for a limited open forum for monuments that were commemorating soldiers who died in combat or whatever. So the city council, they approved this, said private donations of monuments are acceptable within these parameters. And of course, they can't discriminate regarding which religion. And FFRF, you know, wouldn't have anything to say about it. And the ADF was openly gloating about this. They were, you know, they were saying that the FFRF came in, kicked religion out of the public square, but by God, they were getting them back, and they couldn't do anything about this. It was probably Andrew who sent me the email and just said, well, do you want to put this to the test? And we did. We came up with a monument design within their parameters. We got it approved. The city council approved our monument design, said we could have this monument up there for at least a year, at which point I guess they were going to reassess whether they wanted these grounds open up as a public forum or not. And then they waited till we had our monument constructed and we were actually reaching out to them to figure out when we could take it there and leave it on the grounds, do some kind of ceremonial unveiling of this monument on the grounds. And then they said they changed their mind. They're closing the open forum. They took down the Christian cross, and now we're going to sue them. Some people have complained and said that's vindictive on our part, but we also don't want a situation where these places are simply bluffing or feel they're calling our bluff and just waiting to see, you know, at our expense, wait for us to build our monument and only then close down the open forum. So that way we've kind of changed the argument. Our lawyer, one of our lawyers, our primary lawyer, went to a ADF seminar, and he just wanted to see what they were talking about. And they were talking about us through the whole thing. They were deeply concerned that they had done so much work to bring religious liberty into the public square, to make these arguments for the inclusion of religion, and that we were becoming unintended beneficiaries of that. And they, at that point, they didn't know how to handle it. I don't know what kind of arguments they're trying to come up with now, but I think, up until very recently, they were wanting to make the argument in court that we aren't an authentic religion, that we're just satire. That was the entire defense in Arkansas against our Baphomet monument. But now that we've gained IRS recognition, they've had to scrap that entire argument too.
Yeah, that's the best way to go, is beat them at their own game. Steve?
Yeah, a lot of things you're saying resonates personally with me. I actually grew up in Southern California during the Satanic Panic, literally during that time, back in 1983, I believe it was, if you remember the McMartin preschool case, happened in a little town called, I think it was Manhattan Beach, which was a little bit north of Redondo Beach. And this was a preschool that was being charged with satanic ritual abuse of children. They investigated for, I believe, a little over half a decade, didn't find anything, but this led to numerous talk show hosts talking about these topics back in the day. Sally Joseph Raphael and Gerardo Rivera were prevalent in promoting this narrative, spreading widespread panic. Especially a little bit later on, after I graduated high school, they produced, I was called Devil Worship, Exposing Satan's Underground, was a thing that Gerardo Rivera did. And it basically was trying to promote this narrative that there was messages in heavy metal music. Now, I happened to grow up on heavy metal music. Back in my day, I listened to Black Sabbath. I still do, actually. Listen to Black Sabbath, Ozzy Osbourne. And I was very much into occult symbolism. I actually liked the motif. I actually liked the way Theban, you know, the witch's alphabet looked. I liked the way the ruins looked. I liked the Greater Key of Solomon and those types of symbologies. And because of which, people treated me different. People thought that I was satanic during those years because, of course, the Satanic Panic. So nowadays, though, these things are much more mundane. And I'm wondering, have you seen the turnaround, the backlash from these types of things back in the 80s to now, whereas people have become, to the point, desensitized to these types of symbologies? And now it's almost comical when people say things along the lines of like Ozzy Osbourne satanic or Black Sabbath satanic, which, by the way, they started as a Christian group. They all actually are religious. They're all theists, believe it or not. Do you think nowadays that people are like like Kyle said, having this reverse narrative that they're now recognizing that religiosity might be the danger and not necessarily people that happen to like music that deals with satanistic tones or overtones or symbologies?
Well, that's certainly where a lot of people are coming from who immediately embrace the Satanic Temple. In a way, we are the backlash to that. You know, there were a lot of people who grew up in our time being told that the things they loved the most were satanic. And after a while, they believed it. You know, one of our guys in Detroit is in the documentary talking about how he played Dungeons and Dragons all the time. And he loved heavy metal music. And he was very much aware that there was a social campaign against everything he loved the most. And they're telling him that all of this is satanic. And after a while, he just thinks all the better for Satanism, you know? And at the same time, he begins to see these accusations against the church, who are, of course, spreading superstition and malicious lies and the witch hunt against presumed Satanists, also covering up the rape of children. And it doesn't take too much more to convince somebody of the legitimacy of our point of view on this when you have that kind of history. So in a way, the satanic panic, and then now this really kind of realization of the theocratic coup in the United States, have been these kind of two elements that have helped birth this robust satanic movement that I don't think is going to go away. But what's really interesting is to think what this means to the younger generation who just don't understand how dangerous it used to be to identify as a Satanist, even in our own lifetimes. They have no sense of the satanic panic and how they have this moral outrage against different things that we decry as well, but their thinking on the solutions might be really different because they don't really know what it means to be oppressed by the attribution of Satanism. For instance, you have a real kind of anti-free speech movement, and some of the younger people, you know, who come to the Satanic Temple, you know, they'll be calling out for the suppression of right-wing views that they disagree with, and they want more restrictions against what they deem as hate speech, which isn't necessarily wrong as long as you can come up with uniform standards that can be evenly applied and fairly. But you don't want to jump in too hard in a way where you allow some kind of oversight agency to determine on a case-by-case basis what they do and don't like and will suppress and what they'll allow. Because the fact of the matter is even within the lifespan of the Satanic Temple, things have changed so dramatically. But when we would first try to do anything, you would see other religious organizations claiming that what we were trying to do was hate speech against them. And it's not always clear who the minority voice is. You can say, you know, we're just looking out for the minorities, but it's like, well, who's the minority in a case where it's like the Catholics complaining against the Satanic Temple? They'll say we're not a legitimate minority voice. We're just anti-Catholic, right? And there's also those kinds of questions when it comes to heretics of different stripes. My heart goes out to the ex-Muslim heretics. They're usually shit on from all sides, you know? And are they a minority within a minority, or do we consider them assimilated into the broader non-Muslim population who are then denigrating the religious minority of Muslims, right? When you have characters like Ayaan Hirsi Ali or Maryam Namazi, decrying what they felt was an oppressive environment that they, you know, may have grown up with in Muslim culture or whatever else. It's not always clear. So you have to be very circumspect when you're arriving at these issues. So it's interesting to me to see a younger generation already so secure in their identification as Satanists that they don't see a real danger in that kind of thing. And it makes me wonder what the future of Satanism is with the younger generation, that they don't have any sense of just how outsider this was even when we were starting the Satanic Temple.
What is, oh, I'm sorry, Steve, did you have a follow-up for that?
No, go ahead.
What you mentioned free speech there, and like I said, we alluded to this a little bit before we started the stream. One criticism that is oftentimes levied at us is that there are certain subjects, certain people, certain stances, certain arguments, certain debates that just should not be engaged. They should be ignored, pushed aside, exposed, but from far away. Don't engage in that sort of conversation. Why do you think it's important for, like, your opposition to have just an equal voice in a conversation as you do, and why you should have those conversations?
I'm of the strong opinion that mockery can be the best medicine against a stupid idea. Reasoned mockery, you know, not just senseless memeing, but something well thought and something that really confronts the logic and what your opposition is saying. And as somebody who really feels motivated to seek out what's hidden and obscured, the other side of everything, I just can't help but feel that when you suppress somebody's voice, it has the paradoxical effect oftentimes of elevating them. And when I see, say, an idiot like Alex Jones, you know, I mean, he's not really silenced. I mean, he's broadcast all over the place. And that's just one of those things. You shut somebody off one platform, it's not like they're not accessible anywhere else. But right. When you allow somebody to just all of a sudden be the free speech martyr, to put forward this notion that their idea rings so soundly with the truth that it's deemed dangerous by their opposition, must be suppressed, you give it a kind of allure and appeal that it just does not deserve. And I recently made some comment on Twitter, even just to show you how people are so unable to grasp nuance in this discussion. And I was talking about how I left some snarky tweet about how I realize that there are some people who listen to Alex Jones and they might not necessarily subscribe to the most radical ideas put forward on his show, but they view him at least as some skeptical balancing voice against the approved narrative or whatever else. And then I ended up by saying, I think those people are stupid too, because I don't think there's any excuse for justifying the raw, bloviating stupidity of Alex Jones. And I actually got some people saying, well, I thought you believed in free speech. Well, oh. I do. But that includes my ability to say that Alex Jones is a complete idiot. It doesn't mean I agree with every type of speech being put out there. It means that I think this stuff, some of it, should be laid out in the open for absolute evisceration. And it really hurts to see that people can't grasp that very basic kind of premise, that they think that by defending free speech, you defend the ideas, or that you endorse all of the ideas that go along with that, or that if you take a nonviolent stance, that you're simply protecting a certain a type of odious asshole who would otherwise get punched. That's extremely unsophisticated thinking to the point of being childish.
Well said. People don't get what free speech really is. I don't think they think that if it's somebody saying that this idea is stupid, or a platform, you know, deplatforming someone, that too is not infringing on their freedom of speech. It's It's when the government comes in and says, you can't say this, you know, you're silenced by the government. Steve, you see this a lot too, because you talk about it on your channel.
Boy, you don't even know how much preaching to the choir you actually are with all this. I'm sitting here just like, I'm actually like shaking with resonance, because what you said, I've been saying for a very long time, look at, there are ways to mock things and there's ways to appreciate a good argument against something that is just a shit argument, right? Arguing against a theist that you think is a bad idea with a meme is not going to get you very far, right? I mean, but all, like things like young earth creationism, we mock young earth creationism because we think it's fucking asinine, right? We think that the whole thing behind it is completely unscientific. We can actually show, though, that it's unscientific. We can actually show the facts behind it, right? So there is mockery to be had there, but we do it by presenting a good, solid, valid, structured argument with evidence and reason and logic to show why there should be mockery for people to think that we rode on T-Rexes with saddles and things of that nature. So I have to applaud what you just said, because I wish more people would understand those types of things like nuance, because they don't. They literally don't. They want to shut down the conversation if they aren't able to have a conversation on that level. And that's what I noticed the most. The people that could not articulate this type of discussion are the ones that want to retreat into an isolationist chamber or echo chamber and prevent anybody else from having the discussion as well.
I always get this complaint too, that, you know, there's, that I'm a free speech absolutist. And then I get these geniuses pointing out to me that free speech absolutism doesn't exist because we already have restrictions based on, you know, calling out fire in a crowded theater, defamation, things like that. I don't disagree with those restrictions. I think we should have recourse for people to make legal claims against defamation, for people to make claims against death threats. Those are definitely things that should be considered. I mean, not just considered, they should be litigated, and you should absolutely be restricted from doing those kinds of harmful acts. What I'm concerned about is broadening any of these definitions of what constitutes free speech and what does not, broadening definitions of hate speech to become too subjective, that in the hands of whatever officiating agency oversees this, you know, the Satanic Temple could be easily the first bit of collateral damage. Like I said, other church groups that say that, you know, Satanism is by its very nature designed only to offend and mock them, that could find a sympathetic voice within any such officiating organization that would be inclined to hear it, to the point that we would be suppressed. And I just imagine the nightmare of having your voice suppressed and having somebody else define your point of view to the public for you, you know, to the point where all of a sudden we're being claimed to be this kind of hate group that we're not. And that's a very dangerous precedent to set. And it's amazing to me that it's during the Trump administration that so many people are calling for further government restriction upon speech. I mean, who do they think they're giving that power to?
Yeah, that's a scary point. And you hit the nail on the head when you said that. And that's what we're seeing a lot too. And that's what we're going to be talking about tomorrow, is those that are able to, not sort of able, but they don't reflect your stances accurately, and they are trying to paint you under a label or a moniker that doesn't apply to you simply because you disagree with them. And even within factions that you would think would agree most of the time, like churches or, you know, between atheists, you can disagree without dividing those communities. And I think the biggest issue is that somebody will say something to somebody that they disagree with, and because they take it personally, and they're not taking the time to sort of understand that person's actual stance on things, they're letting one thing cloud their judgment.
Well, you can agree to what the appropriate ends are, right? You can agree that you want equal rights for marginalized groups, and you can disagree on tactic. And what we're finding is that it, or what I'm finding is that if I disagree regarding tactic of what's the best tactic to get to what we think is the ultimate social structure, I guess, then we're denigrated as having thrown in with the opposition. I mean, then we're nothing short of Nazis just for the fact that we have these kind of tactical disagreements. And I like to think that we approach this by looking at the evidence. You know, I've written essays about this and justified my opinions with, I feel, case studies and other types of analyses put forward by those who investigate these types of issues. And I've written about free speech and nonviolence. And that has been enough in some cases to get people to feel like I'm only defending the opposition, which is absurd and again, outright infantile.
Mm-hmm. So let me ask you this real quick. What do you suggest to somebody where there comes a time where, like you said, people agree with the ends, right? I think most of us in our community, we have a lot of the same mindsets. We want a lot of the same similar things, right? But as you said, tactics are important. How you get there is important. We all have different roads, and I do believe it takes a village. I do believe it takes multiple different paths, and I do believe it takes multiple different inputs and opinions. Now, when we get suggestions and other people get suggestions on different ways of doing things, we evaluate it like any other, you know, group. But what do you say about the people that feel like when their opinion is not being taken on board, or at least not even to the point where, well, I should say that when we evaluate the opinion, but we find that opinion to be not conducive to the tactic that we want to use, fine for somebody else, and that they will then again try to retreat in some type of isolationism, some kind of secularism, and some type of seclusion, and just kind of tell everybody else, well, if they're not going to take my advice, then I don't want to be a part of that organization any longer. I find that to be odd. I find that to be unproductive, to say the least. I mean, if somebody doesn't take your advice and they want to do things their own way, I don't see the issue to be had there. If you're not the ones, you know, the one in charge making those final executive type decisions.
Well, we had an incident where we wanted to go after Twitter. Right. Twitter just would not verify our accounts, for one thing, and they wouldn't even get back to us on the request to do so, which is somewhat minor. But what happened later on seemed a bit more severe. We get death threats on Facebook all the time, and Facebook has never taken them seriously as violating their community standards. We always get this form letter back that says this does not violate our community standards, when in fact it does. That kind of targeting of a religious group, that kind of harassment, even straight up death threats, Facebook does not take action on. And Twitter hasn't been much better. And there was a case, but it all came to a head when some woman tweeted something out one time saying something about burning down our headquarters in Salem, Massachusetts. There was some news article talking about how we had opened our headquarters, and she tweeted out some encouragement that somebody should go burn it down. And this wouldn't have gotten noticed probably if it hadn't been for former child actor Corey Feldman retweeting it. And then, you know, a lot of people saw it, and I feel like, you know, allowing threats like that to go unchallenged when you actually have standards against it, pre-existing standards against it that are directly stated, really does say something, I think, to the general public about how they can think of us. And it's kind of dangerous to us. I don't want people thinking that the rest of the world kind of agrees that we're these villains who deserve to have our place burned down or be murdered, and have this notion that they'd be considered heroes by the world at large if they went and did so. So I'm reporting this threat to Twitter, and Twitter got back and said it didn't violate their terms of service. So I retweeted the tweet, And I asked my followers to also report the tweet until somebody at Twitter realized that they were in error, that this really was a violation of their terms of service and they should take it down. Twitter responded by permanently suspending my account because it was targeted harassment. My retweeting it and asking this was targeted harassment against the woman who was asking for our headquarters to be burnt down. And even worse, they banned the Satanic Temple's Twitter account at the same time, just due to its association with me. And then that very weekend, which came like 2 days later, some guy came to our headquarters and tried to stab me with a, you know, this makeshift shiv or whatever, very mentally ill kind of guy. And I had no idea whether this was, had any inspiration in this or whatever else. But I wrote something just claiming that, you know, this kind of environment was being fomented by this attitude that death threats against us were uniquely unintrusive in some way and didn't need to be handled in the same way that any other death threat would need to be handled, or threat of violence or harassment or whatever else. And it started getting, it started generating media. I did an interview with Newsweek and they posted something about it. Then Fox posted something. So then shortly thereafter, Twitter reversed their position, but they still wouldn't verify it. And then a lawyer reached out offering to go pro bono on taking on Twitter on this for religious discrimination. And we thought it would be interesting, you know, at the very least, we would learn where Twitter kind of stands on this. And, you know, the whole social media environment is kind of this open frontier now where it's like, are they private entities? And is Facebook legitimately considered a private entity, being that it accepts all these kinds of government funds to do what it does and sells its data to the NSA and everybody else? It's, you know, these are all kind of big questions which are, would be interesting to explore in litigation. So we accepted this this lawyer's pro bono support and said, have at it. And then we started getting messages that this lawyer was this kind of alt-right lawyer. And people from inside the Satanic Temple were concerned that we'd be viewed as alt-right if we were using this lawyer for these services. The lawyer himself describes himself as extremely left-wing. Nearly communist is how he put it. And people were messaging me and they're saying, well, he's also defended this guy and somebody else. And, and now they'll say he defends Alex Jones, but Alex Jones hired him after this guy offered pro bono support to us. But they never seem to mention that he also represents or represented P.Z. Myers, you know, and P.Z. Myers is very much on the left. And he, and the lawyer also represents some kind of feminist Muslims women's organization. I guess he also has this whole kind of list of far left organizations he's represented. He's just apparently hardcore First Amendment. But it didn't really matter to me. I don't get a lawyer approaching us with pro bono support. And I don't ask a lawyer in that situation how he voted. You know, the lawyer is a functionary to me. The lawyer is a tool. I don't care what the lawyer's political position is. And people were really outraged, some people within the Satanic Temple, saying that we needed to drop this lawyer or people would think that we were Nazis. And I was trying to be diplomatic in this type of thing, but I was also asking people to answer me the basic question of how would we be supporting any kind of progressive cause by dumping this guy as a lawyer? And how would we be helping the alt-right, even if he were this alt-right lawyer, by utilizing his services? What were the costs and you know, what were the benefits? And if they could point to something that would indicate that we were doing some kind of tangible harm by using a lawyer, which I, as I said, to me is just a tool in this kind of fight, then this could be brought to consideration. Nobody could do that. And yet it didn't take long before the idea that we could be seen as Nazis became, well, you're Nazis, or you're secretly alt-right, or you're crypto-fascist, or whatever else, which I thought was also just this kind of foot-stamping childishness that didn't come from a place of reason at all. And there was no real legitimate excuse for that kind of behavior, I didn't think. You just simply can't judge a lawyer by their clients. I mean, for fuck's sake, think about criminal defense. You know, you don't hold it against a criminal defense lawyer for having defended murderers and rapists. And it's not about the client sometimes themselves, is it? You know, it's about due process. It's about making sure that in the course of having somebody convicted for what they've done, even if they're guilty, that you're not setting new precedent that later on is used as a bludgeon against innocent people. And that mm-hmm. kind of brought me back to the Satanic Panic, because some of the early precedent that convicted people in the Satanic Panic was set on bad evidence against people who were arguably bad people. One of the first kind of recovered memory cases was this Franklin guy. I forget the full name, but the details were is that his daughter claimed that under the course of hypnosis, she recalled him murdering this missing girl in her neighborhood, who I think was a friend of hers. And there wasn't good evidence that this had actually happened. Everything she stated that she remembered could have been found in newspaper clippings and everything else. But it seemed like her father really was an abusive asshole, right? But that didn't mean that this evidence was good to convict him of this murder. And I think because there was good evidence that he was an abusive asshole, that these claims were taken much more seriously. They were willing to set a precedent that later on really damaged the lives of innocent people who were being bludgeoned by these claims of recovered memories of abuse, of things that almost certainly didn't happen. And some people spent upwards of 20 years in prison. Some people just being released in recent times who were convicted during the Satanic Panic. That's the reason you hold the due process. That's the reason why, even if somebody's guilty, you make sure that they have the best representation that they could have. It's not because you agree with the crime. It's not because you want them to get away with the crime, but you want to be certain that nobody else is a victim to what they did. You know, you want to make sure that you're not causing a witch hunt just by putting a guilty person away. And I feel like a lot of these premises are kind of basic civics, and a lot of those values just aren't ingrained in people's heads today.
Yeah, you know, just recently they overturned the convictions of the Kellers, Fran and Dan Keller. They were convicted in the early, what was it, 90s, early 90s, and they were convicted for this whole satanic stuff, for having satanic rituals. I don't remember if it was their child or they were babysitting the child, but they were sentenced almost 50 years, and they didn't get out until 2013, just very recently.
They spent 20 years in prison. They spent like around 20 years in prison on supernatural tales that absolutely had no basis in reality. And how do you give somebody that back? I mean, I think they won like a $3.6 million from the state or something, but 20 years of your life, and there's no multiple millions in money you can give somebody that will get that back. Their lives are forever stained by what happened there. And I think that's absolutely, you know, that's a product of due process being undermined in the course of a witch hunt. And you can have witch hunts for all kinds of things that do exist in the real world. You know, we often look at the Red Scare, and everybody recognizes that as a modern day witch hunt. Now, that doesn't mean that communists didn't exist. You know, there were communist infiltrators even in the United States. It was just that the reaction was overblown, and people took to looking amongst their own allies for secret communist threat amongst them. And you don't want any cause to degenerate into that. No matter how outraged you are today against the alt-right or anybody else, you don't want to fall into that trap where you're looking amongst your allies for secret clues that are grossly implausible. You know, this idea that different progressive left organizations are only secretly only secretly fascist and trying to insinuate themselves into this kind of leftist culture just to suddenly pull the rug out from under them and say, oh, surprise, you joined up with us, now you're a Nazi kind of thing. That's when you've crossed the line into a witch hunt. And that's not to say that there's not some problem with far right nationalism, that there is not really odious behavior, of course, on the part of what is generally termed as the alt-right. It just means we can't let them tear us apart by making us look at ourselves and cannibalize one another for this kind of impotent rage we have and having no other approach onto how to actually confront the real enemy right before our faces. I mean, it's disappointing how easy it seems for progressive movements to be undermined by those kinds of purity tests. And I think it's something that's really held us back from a lot of progress.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's a big reason, in my opinion, that Trump actually became president, is because people who on the right that maybe would have come over to the Democrat side see these sort of infighting and this cannibalization over these labels, pejoratives, whatever you want to call them, and they default to the guy that's not gonna that's as far away from that as possible. But you, speaking of jail, you mentioned there very quickly, and I just want to hear the story on this. You were attacked by a guy with a makeshift knife, out of the blue.
He didn't make any definitive moves to actually stab me. I managed to kind of talk him out of it. He was standing there and he was threatening, and everything was on our security cameras outside our headquarters in Salem, and I warned him, you know, in all confidence, looking him in the face, that I would fuck him up if he did so. Whether I would have or not, I don't know, but it's important to have confidence and look somebody in the eye when you're saying that kind of thing. And it dissuaded him long enough that the cops arrived and they arrested him, and he was just some mentally ill guy.
You know, it's funny that this is exactly what we spoke about the other day, when somebody was advocating the position that if they didn't like what you were saying and felt that it was verbal violence, whatever that would entail. I do not believe in any way, shape, or form words can be held to a standard of being a violence. But if they didn't like that, this is the Antifa type narrative, that they could proactively attack you. They could actually try to silence you, quote, and this is their quote, by any means necessary. This is scary. This is something that actually is the antithesis of what I want to see in a society that is predicated upon having free speech, free dialogue, and open communications, and where the best ideas should hopefully win. Now, they don't always do that. That's unfortunate. But I think overall, the best ideas do eventually win. They do eventually go to the surface. But when you have somebody who advocates a position like the person on Twitter that said, you know, that they should burn down the building of yours, I don't understand that narrative. It makes absolutely no sense to me whatsoever. It doesn't do anything to help anybody promote their ideas. And it just sends a chilling effect to anybody that has a disagreement and says things that you don't like to hear. Especially on Twitter, where it's I'll quote this from SJ, for people we've seen her say it, she got it actually right. It's a microblogism of hell. It's basically just a microcosm of microblogging of hell, I think she put it. And if you can't handle somebody saying things that you don't want to hear on Twitter, there are other means by which you don't have to listen to it. Mute and block.
Well, I think people don't realize just how dedicated we are to a scientific worldview. Even when I talk about nonviolence, I'm looking at research. And I wrote a whole essay about this. There's been a lot of research done out of places like Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and other kind of research that compiles data based on dissident political movements and other kind of radical protest movements and things like that. And they've sought to determine what tactics work best. And you know, all the evidence shows right now that the nonviolent movements, especially when it comes to some kind of marginalized kind of political protest movement, like the Satanic Temple could be considered when we're confronting these kinds of general kind of cultural issues, nonviolent tactics are the most effective. Violent groups, they tend to very quickly lose the support of the public. They tend very quickly to lose their own voice on their own terms. They create a kind of general fear in the population. They create a real backlash. They tend to fall apart in amongst themselves. And nonviolent movements just have a much better chance of putting forward a sustained, lasting message that really has an effect and really meets its intended goals. I mean, these aren't questions we approach just on some kind of knee-jerk moralistic reaction. I mean, I suppose we would rethink our position on whether we want to completely work within legal means if the legal environment changed to our disadvantage sufficiently that we felt the laws were oppressive and unworkable. But as for now, there would be no excuse with the Satanic Temple because, as I said, on paper, we're a secular nation. You know, constitutionally, we have equal rights as any other religious voice. We have the system working in our favor. It would just be absolutely foolish for us to pull some kind of actions which could be easily have us deemed a terroristic organization or strike fear into people who might otherwise embrace the message we're putting forward. And of course, we don't want to live in a more violent world. We don't want to live in a world of more social unrest. So there would be really no justifying us making the world a worse place in the name of some kind of increased equity, which should already be in place. And we're just trying to remind people of.
Mm-hmm. And I have, I'm going to ask about one more thing. Believe it or not, when we have these talks that Steve and I are just enthralled in, that's when time goes by the fastest. We're already at the hour and 15 minute mark. And I want to leave time for questions from the audience that have super chatted. We'll get to those here in just a second, but I guess, and I'm sure that you deal with this on a daily basis. Probably one of the criticisms that's levied against you guys is why push for the change in status? Why become a religion when that's the thing that, you know, you sought to sort of be the antithesis of? How would you answer that?
Well, I would start out by saying we never denied being a religion. From the very beginning, we sought to separate superstition from religion. And I've always had a problem with the anti-religion rhetoric. And that's been very difficult for some atheists to embrace or understand. You know, there's been some real pushback there. But to me, religion doesn't mean theism. It doesn't mean supernaturalism. It doesn't mean superstition. Jainism is a non-theistic religion. Buddhism, Confucianism. Religion can have all these kinds of positive elements without the superstition involved. And as I've said, you know, we have this kind of subculture. We have this kind of identity. We have this metaphorical narrative placement that kind of contextualizes us within our cultural environment. And we feel we have all the enriching aspects of a religion while not having the superstition involved. And furthermore, religion enjoys certain privileges and exemptions in the United States that shouldn't only be available to people who claim they believe in these intellectually insulting fairy tales. Nonetheless, from the beginning, we did say that we were not going to seek that recognition for tax exemption because we rejected the idea that churches should be tax exempt. They should pay their taxes, right? And also, we wanted to be able to be involved in politics without violating the Johnson Amendment. And we kind of naively thought, given precedent of recent years, that nobody in the courts would question our claims to being religion, because the courts have, you know, in recent times, just given a carte blanche to religious claims and haven't questioned them at all. Look at the Hobby Lobby case, where nobody even asked in the Supreme Court how it is that a private corporation could hold a religious viewpoint, or where was any scriptural support for this notion that a corporation holding a religion should not provide healthcare benefits that provided contraceptive benefits to its employees. They just said it was a religious claim, and that was taken at face value. I guess we had this kind of notion that the courts would be more consistent in religious claims than to tolerate somebody coming in and saying, I don't think these guys are a real religion. We were wrong. Like I said, with our Baphomet campaign in Arkansas, which was our claim to put up a satanic monument on the same public grounds where they put up a Ten Commandments monument, the state constructed its entire defense on the idea that we're not a real religion. We knew for one thing that if we got the recognition from the IRS, being the only federal agency that has a test, a religious test, that those claims would not, definitely not be taken seriously by the court. The court couldn't even, if they were inclined to, then call that into question. So that saves us quite a deal of argument in the courts, and that costs a lot of money to begin with. But I was also getting nervous that the window was kind of closing on a time in which we could, if we wanted to, be declared a religion by IRS standards, when Trump announced that he was going to look for some way to revoke the status of the Church of Scientology. Now, as much as I might dislike them, I thought it was a bizarre thing for him to say, and it made me wonder what kind of justification they would come up with for narrowing the definition of what a religion is to try to define us out of it. And that could actually be a first step into trying to denigrate our own claims, you know, the more kind of popular we get for taking on the claims of evangelicals in the courts. So we didn't want that window to close. And then it was really at the point, though, where Trump announced that he was going to go after the Johnson Amendment entirely. And for anybody who doesn't know, the Johnson Amendment is what is put into place to deny tax-exempt churches the ability to involve themselves in politics. Trump announced that he was going to destroy the Johnson Amendment, and then he shortly thereafter announced that they weren't going to pursue any enforcement of the Johnson Amendment. So that was the point where we realized that we are in asymmetric warfare, that where the odds are stacked against us in this culture war, and we need any advantage we can take. And we felt also our time was maybe limited on being able to apply for that before that definition of religion was narrowed. And to be clear, I think if they narrow the definition of religion, it will, any way they do it, will arguably be unconstitutional and could go to the courts. But I don't think we'd have standing to challenge that if we hadn't already been approved as a religion, had it taken away. So I felt it was really kind of necessary for us at this time to apply for that status, and we did, and we got it.
Very cool. For a 501c3, what do they use for? Do they use Durkheim's definitions of religion for a unified system of beliefs and practices?
I don't think they use. I think they have their own kind of unique 14 points that where you fulfill these certain requirements if you do a number of these certain things. And I was worried that maybe they had too much subjective latitude, because they tell you that you don't need to fill all these requirements, but you need to fill a number of them. They don't give you an exact metric, right? So it's still left to some kind of subjective interpretation. But when you look at those requirements, we meet, I think, we arguably meet all of them. There is one standard which is obviously geared towards Christian groups, where it says, if you have like some kind of Sunday school for children. And I was thinking we arguably meet that standard with our after school Satan club, which we set up in opposition to evangelical groups going into public schools. The fact that it doesn't take place on Sunday, I think, really can't be held against us. You know, it's it was their critical thinking classes without any type of religious teaching that we've set up for children. But the, you know, critical thinking is something that we feel inspired to advance based upon our own religious tenets. So that one's a little shaky, but otherwise, I thought it would be very difficult for them to deny us because we do fulfill so many. We have a place of, as they would call it, worship, even though we kind of we don't really agree with that terminology. But we also have, you know, regular, as they term it, congregations, you know, in this kind of body of literary work and all these other types of practices and other things that we were able to point to that we fulfill the requirements of. So I don't really feel that the IRS would have had any excuse to turn us down. That doesn't mean I felt entirely confident that we would get the approval as quickly as we did, but I was happy to see we didn't have to fight too hard.
Congrats. You guys definitely deserve it. Okay, so what we're going to do now is I'm going to go through these super chats. There's quite a few. I'm going to, whether it be to whoever in the panel the question is asked to, let's just try to keep the answers. Steve, there's a couple for you on here too. Just try to keep the answers as succinct as possible just because of the sheer volume of the amount of them. And then we will let Lucian tell us once again about the film and where you can see it and where you can find out more. We start out with Reed Charbonneau says, how's the movie doing? I love your work, Lucian. I guess now would be a good time to plug the film.
Yeah, well, the movie's doing great. It's gotten almost universally good reviews. Like I said, I think the real backlash will happen once it's streaming and everybody else sees it. It's increased our profile and my own popularity. I'm getting recognized all the time, much to my my discomfort. But also, I think people should realize, like, we didn't make that film, and we're not getting any money from it. So, you know, it's great to see it doing well, and we're happy. It's a good film. I like it a lot. But people asking us these kinds of questions of where it's at and everything, you kind of have to check with the distributor Magnolia and their website, HailSatanFilm.com, and realize that, you know, we're not the ones making the posters and the advertising and things like that, because we do get a lot of questions that are better geared towards the filmmakers and the distributor.
Excellent. Prophet of Cthulhu says, how is the lawsuit with Netflix going?
Oh, that was settled. That was settled pretty quickly. And you can make of that what you will regarding the legitimacy of the claim. But as part of the settlement, of course, I just really can't talk about it other than to say that it was amicably settled.
Perfect. The Stoned Apostate, that's a super chat without a message. Thank you. Jay Lee said, aren't you guys just successful trolls who aim for a pure secular society?
Well, we do aim for a secular society, but that's separate from the question of whether we're purely trolling. But no, I think sometimes people are disappointed that we have this authentic attachment to Satanism. But I think if they learn about it, they might become a bit more comfortable with that as well. And all I can say is check out the material we have on thesatanictemple.com.
Kwiasa says, what is the reaction of the temple to the recent crazy abortion bans coming from southern state legislators? And does the temple have anything planned for that?
I have an official statement on that, and it is just three words: we will fight. And I encourage people to check out religiousreproductiverights.com. It shows our approach to this. It shows how we've already approached abortion restrictions in the past and how we can approach it in the future. I mean, it's an issue of having a plaintiff and standing in these certain states, but it's also an issue of just having the resources to take it on. When we took on two cases in Missouri, We just did not find pro bono support. We thought we would, because we thought there'd be a lot of lawyers just really kind of willing to make the religious exemption claim from against abortion restrictions. But no, we found there's a lot of lawyers not willing to break new grounds, not willing to represent Satanists. So, and some of these lawsuits can be prohibitively expensive. The lawsuits in Missouri run us in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. And so far, there's not much to show for it. But I do think we're on the front line of fighting against these draconian restrictions.
Mm-hmm. And Reed Shabato, thank you for the second super chat. He says that every atheist should join Lucian in the fight against the growing theocratic encroachment of tyranny we're living in, the most active organization pushing against the embodiment of celestial tyranny. Quite a statement.
Yeah, I mean, Satanism isn't for everybody, and it's not for every atheist either. If Satanism doesn't resonate with you, maybe you're just an ally of the kinds of fights we fight. But one thing I would ask of any atheist is to stop making this a fight against religion. Change your terminology, make it a fight against superstition, and start embracing the idea that you have deeply held beliefs, you have items of religious opinion, and as such, you should not be a second-class citizen with diminished civic capacities just because you don't hold to supernatural beliefs. You should have the same privileges and exemptions as anybody with a religious point of view when it comes to legalistic claims of conscience.
Okay, and there's quite a few of these. 0132132. Hail Sagan, read again. Hail Black Sabbath and Metal, Cajun Crustacean, Hail Santana. Janice Hall says, all new information for me. Great perspective. Keep up the great work, Lucian. Chief Nerd, if you have not seen the movie, it is well worth the time. Sisfrido Sarah Bia says, if Satanic Temple is not supernatural, isn't atheism?
Isn't atheism a religion is probably what it means to say. But I just, you know, no, atheism's not a religion. Atheism just describes what you're not. As atheists ourselves, we're also Satanists. We're not saying that atheism is a religion. And I get tired of seeing these quips over and over again that atheism is a religion, like bald is a hairstyle and things like that. Yes, I get it. But atheism is nothing more than saying you don't believe in some kind of ethereal deity. With Satanism, we define what our ethics are, and we have that kind of cultural identity that stands apart from the atheism itself. We're a non-theistic religion.
Well said. Prophet of Cthulhu, how long do you think it will be until the U.S. views the character of Satan not as an enemy, but as a rebel liberator like Prometheus?
When we come out victorious in this current culture war, and even before, as more and more people realize just how depraved and corrupt this current theocratic movement is in the name of spreading Christianity all over the place, the more it becomes impossible to put these kinds of pluralistic values into a Judeo-Christian context because of this movement. People will more and more see the value in what the Satanic Temple is doing, and because of that, more and more they'll see the symbolic value of Satan the same way we do.
And Magdalena, you were the first person to try to convince me to get Lucian on. So I owe you, we are in a great debt of gratitude to you for bringing that idea up. And I think she's happy because she says, this is amazing. Thank you. Love and hugs. So I hope it was everything that you wanted.
Love and hugs to Magdalena. She's been following me on Facebook and Twitter for some time. She's in Poland, and she's great. Love you, Magdalena.
Perfect. Well, she is responsible for tonight's stream. So thank you very much, Magdalena. Riggles World says hate speech is definitely too vague of a term to be used effectively in legislation. Anything you wanted to tag in on that? That's more of a comment.
Yeah, no. And like I said, I always like to leave myself open to new ideas on how to approach things better. So when people say I'm an absolutist on anything, that's just inaccurate. And I think, as I said, speaking earlier, like if you can come up with a way to lessen the danger in the kind of irresponsible speech put forward by an asshole like Alex Jones or anything like that, in a way that can be applied in principle, meaning that it can be equally applied broadly and uniformly in a way that it doesn't allow for this kind of subjective analysis on a case-by-case basis that allows certain people to be censored based upon the preferences of whoever is doing the censoring, then, you know, those things can be put into consideration. But until then, you know, you're playing a very dangerous game. And I think kind of, you know, we've made a lot of progress. People like to talk about how many steps backwards we've taken. But, you know, in my own lifetime alone, we've seen a lot, you know, we've seen violence dramatically decline in the United States. You know, there's been kind of an uptick lately, but it doesn't mean that a data point is necessarily indicative of a trend. And I kind of feel like the social environment is very similar to the ecological environment, where if you unbalance one element, you know, you might look at it, start suffering ramifications in ways you didn't intend elsewhere. And that's not to say we shouldn't touch anything or that there's not a whole lot of work to be done, but we should also recognize what we've done right and be very circumspect when we're talking about initiating new programs like broadening our definition of what hate speech is. Because like I said, I really see the Satanic Temple as easily being an unintended consequence of that, to it, with how many people like to kind of put words in our mouths and try to define us on their own terms.
Mm-hmm. And that was a very good analogy, I think, too, with the environment. I like that. Poll Center says, workers of all countries unite. Grasa, viva la revolucion. Poll Center again. Lucifer is the champion of the poor and the enemy of the rich. Pokepartum depression. Man, these names are, you guys are creative. Let me tell you, you guys are very creative. Hail Satan. Comfiest of all cloths. Sigfrido again. Flat earthers exist. Hail Satan.
What's all this Reed? Flat earth shit? That's the fault of you guys. Flat earth shit, and I was wondering, like, what? I wasn't really concerned because you seem to have the endorsement of people who like
oh, yeah, they're
for
love
a while to be on the show. But.
Think of this as a thorn. We are the thorn in Flat Earth's side. Like we do every week. We have a thing called Flatterday Nights, where we usually do two-hour debates on Saturday nights, and we bring in astrophysicists, people who like measure these using these sensitive instruments in the seas for tsunamis, so they know what they're talking about, and they can lay out a case for anyone to be able to see that if you are following the flat earth, you are absolutely just an idiot, or you are willfully turning a blind eye to truth. And there's a very, we do that for a very good reason. It's funny, yes, but there's a bigger sort of thing behind it, is because I think flat earth culminates a group of people who are jaded. They think that the systems lied to them. They don't believe in empirical you know, evidence or facts. They are willing to wave their hand, dismiss it, and think that that's okay, and that's going to be the way the world works, and that's, and it's growing. Like the movement's growing. It's not like this is a,
I know, it's so depressing to me, but on the other side, yeah, I don't I don't object to you confronting that, because I have to admit, when I was much younger, I learned so much about evolutionary biology just by learning the refutations to creationist arguments. And It wasn't so much that I was embraced creationist arguments. It was just that that manner of presentation, reading the refutations, was generally more fun than just flat biology textbooks, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Absolutely.
I seriously learned more about biology in dealing with creationism in the last 6 years than I actually did in college when I took biology. So I learned a lot more of the nuances of the arguments, but by far. Absolutely.
There's a big difference there, though, guys. But like, I see what the comparison that you're making. There's a huge difference, though, in something that there are a lot of questions in. Like, you know, you cannot question the shape of the Earth. This is something that is black and white. It is something that is absolutely provable. So my where the riddle is for me is, why are these individuals choosing to ignore? Because literally,
I've had this theory for a while that this is a case of somebody started out fucking with people, like, yes, somebody revived flat Earth as a way of trying to illustrate the nature of idiotic claims, and then it took off. I can't believe that somebody came at this in earnest and was just. The whole flat Earth thing was entirely like this quaint antiquity of idiotic thinking, and it's just depressing. It's just depressing that there can even be a population who's that scientific.
Edgewise, he used, oddly enough, Google Earth, which is a globe, to look at the continent of Africa, and there's a ridge on the left-hand side that comes from the top and sort of swoops around. He has convinced himself that that is a fossilized dragon, and that back in the day, God sent this dragon down because the continents were stacked on top of each other like a burger, and it was the dragon's job to place the continents back where they are. And now that sounds ridiculous, and if it was, I think you would have somebody do a video on it and leave it. He spins hours doing video after video after video, detailing every single mark in that ridge, showing you that this is a dragon. Like, this is
and
not
we have people that think that mountains are titans that laid down and just they died and became mountain rangers. And people think that Wyoming, the Devil's Tower in Wyoming, is actually a tree stump from when giants used to walk the earth and do forestry, I guess.
It's not a hobby. He really
It's really stuff they believe.
Well, if your conclusion is your starting point, you tend to find the evidence somewhere. You look hard enough.
But they won't listen to you try to explain that to them. It's wild. It's wild. Well, you should join us one Saturday night. I think you'd have fun.
Yeah, really. Yeah, you would really have fun doing a flat earth thing if you didn't lose your mind. It's very draining, to say the least, and taxing to deal with some of these people.
We just got a couple more here, and then we'll close this out. Reed says, pin his philosophy, done. Uncle Ned, he said the Satanic Temple is basically science in a religion. That being said, hell, Satan. Prol Center, America is incredibly violent. The U.S. military has killed millions around the globe in resource grabs and war of aggression. Tubian 323 says, does the Satanic Temple do weddings or funerals? That's a good question.
Yeah, right now we have very few people we have actually officially ordained, but we're working hard now on putting together our ordination coursework to make sure that our ordained really understand exactly who we are and where we're coming from, that they can represent us properly. And then once we roll that out, you'll see, I think, ordained satanic ministers all over the place.
Excellent. It's that time of the evening, ladies and gentlemen, where we get the super chat from our resident critic, Christian Artisan Tony. I cannot wait to see what Artisan Tony has in store for us on this particular Dream? Good show, guys. Wow.
Wow. Thank you, Tony. That's high praise indeed.
Wow. Just remember, in the end, we were all created by the same creator. Group hug with Satan. There's so much in that to unpack, but I'm just going to say thank you. And as always, fuck you, Tony. Reed Charbonneau says, Steve and Lucian do philosophy next. Yeah, that'd be good between the two of you. There's one last one.
Yeah.
One last one. I'm carrying this over from last night. This was from the Orange show. Where's Steve? I said I would carry this one over. I didn't know if you'd want to.
No. I mean, by the way, I did watch. I thought it was a really good episode. I did enjoy listening to that, by the way.
And if you want to address that.
Hopefully after Arn gets back from Europe, things will be all nice and lovey-dovey. I love Arn. I mean, he's a great guy. And it's funny, you mentioned a lot of names that we actually know, and it's kind of weird hearing the experience you have with them. Like, like PZ Myers was a big fan of my channel. Now he's not so much a fan of this channel. I don't know what it is. He seems to have like completely done like a 180 on us, but man. Arn's great. Have you ever talked to Arn? Lucian?
Me? Oh yeah, yeah. No, yeah. He was speaking at the same American Atheist conference that I was speaking at back in, I don't remember when. I'm terrible with dates, but yeah. Nice fellow.
He's a hero.
Yeah.
He's my hero. That's the guy that single-handedly got me out of religion. I watched one of his videos after a youth group night, and church had ended, and somebody was watching it, and I went home and pulled the video back up and was just amazed by the stuff that was in the Bible that we didn't know was there. You don't preach on Sunday.
I have to tell you, it's the most gratifying thing to hear that, because people have said that of me. I went to speak in Utah one time, and all these ex-Mormons were coming up to me, and this one kid came up and said that he was out on the missions, and he started watching videos of me speaking and came to embrace the Satanic Temple. And I thought that, that was such a nice thing to hear. But also, I was kind of amazed that there were no intermediary steps. You went straight from the Satanist.
I was
out on the mission. So.
Yeah, going from Mormon to Satanism is pretty well one extreme to the other.
That is well, out on the mission. So
well, on a mission, is, even yeah.
Well, Lucian, I want to thank you once again for taking the time to join us. This was fantastic. We would love to have you on again, and because like. We didn't get to probably half of sort of the questions, just because when we have guests like this that are making impacts the way they are, you can't, I don't think, plan for a certain set of questions. You're required to come back now because we have to get the answers to those questions. But
you made a pact with the devil being us this time.
Yeah.
Anytime. Just let me know and we'll work it out.
And please let people know where they can follow you, where they can donate. I've seen some questions about that, where people can go to donate for specific things. Where can they go and do all that stuff?
Well, I mean, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm Lucian Greaves. And other than that, the Satanic Temple is also on Facebook and Twitter, but check our primary website, thesatanictemple.com. And if you're wondering, as a lot of people often do when I do an appearance, if there's a local chapter near you, you can check on thesatanictemple.com for updates of which official chapters are active right now.
Awesome. Steve, anything? From you,
no, minute. I just wanted to thank you for joining us. This is actually one of those rare things where I actually am thoroughly engrossed in the topic and find the guest to be just somebody that we could probably talk for like 4 hours on. Unfortunately, we have time constraints, but that's why we're going to make a pact with you to try to get you back on, because I know from experience that the people that are listening right now and watching right now, I mean, they are just. They're just elated right now. Before we even got you on, people were messaging us how thankful they were to have you on, and I'm sure they're going to be thankful after you're on. So make sure that you are subscribing to him and finding him on Twitter and letting him know that we were, as non sequitur fans, we were very appreciative of him coming on and talking about the Satanic Temple.
And to you guys,
well, to listeners, I love them all. I'm thrilled that people are so thrilled to hear me babble for a while.
It was a great suggestion. So keep them about. Actually, I only think we've gotten one bad suggestion from someone. That just went bad. But that's for another time. We'll see you back here tomorrow for the ACA and Rationality Rules tomorrow at 9:00. And then we will gear up for a conspiracy weekend, actually, because on Friday we will be debating whether or not we landed on the moon. Until tomorrow.
Thank you.